suddenly, yanking her back to the present, and Charlie hugged herself tightly, though it didn't really help. It was everywhere, sharp and hot. She clenched her jaw, unwilling to make a sound. Sometimes it eased to an ache she could push to the back of her awareness. Sometimes it vanished for days at a time, but always it came back. "Were you hurt?" John had asked, the first, the only, sign he'd given that he might still care, and she had been unable to reply. "Yes," she could have said. "Yes, I was, and I still am. Sometimes I think I'll die of it, and what I feel now is just an echo of what it used to be. It feels like all my bones are broken. It feels like my guts are twisted and torn. It feels like my head has cracked open, and things are leaking out, and it happens again and again." She clenched her teeth, taking deliberate breaths, until it began slowly to recede. "Charlie, are you okay?" Jessica said quietly, appearing beside her on the sidewalk outside Clay's house. Charlie nodded.
"I didn't hear you come over," she said hoarsely.
"He doesn't mean to hurt you. He's just traumatized," Charlie snapped.
"I know,"
Jessica sighed, and Charlie shook her head.
"Sorry, I didn't mean to be rude."
"I know," Jessica said. Charlie sighed, closing her eyes. "He's not the one who died, and it did feel like dying." She could only remember that crucial night in fragments. Her thoughts were all scraps and whispers, hazy and muddled, everything circling slowly around a central point, the single, unmistakable snapping sound of the spring locks. Charlie shivered and felt Jessica's hand touch her shoulder. She opened her eyes, looking helplessly at her friend.
"I think he just needs time," Jessica said gently.
"How much time can he need?" Charlie asked, and the words sounded like stone. Chapter 3. "It's ready," a soft voice rang out in the dark.
"I'll tell you when it's ready," said the man slumped in the corner, studying a monitor intently. "Raise it a few more degrees," he whispered.
"You've said before that might be too much," she said from the opposite corner, leaning over a table. The light shimmered off her contours as she carefully examined what lay before her.
"Do it," the slumped man said.
The woman touched a dial, then recoiled suddenly.
"What is it?"
he demanded. He didn't take his eyes off the monitor.
"Raise it 2 more degrees, he ordered, his voice rising.
For a moment, the room was silent. Finally, the man turned toward the table.
"Is there a problem?"
"I think it's..." The woman trailed off.
"What?"
"Moving," she finished.
"Of course it is. Of course they are."
"It looks like it's in pain," she whispered. The man smiled.
"Yes."
A bright light flashed on abruptly as a sudden noise resounded from the center of the room. Red, green, and blue lights flashed in sequence, and a cheerful voice erupted from the speakers embedded in the walls, filling the room with song. Every light shone down on him, the sleek, white, and purple bear. His joints clicked with every pivot. His eyes jolted back and forth randomly. He stood about 6 feet high, his rosy cheeks like 2 balls of bright cotton candy, and he wielded a microphone with a head like a shimmering disco ball.
"Shut that thing off,"
the slouched man shouted, getting to his feet with obvious difficulty. He moved slowly toward the center of the room,
leaning heavily on his cane.
"Get back! I'll do it myself!" he screamed as the woman retreated to the table in the corner.
The man pried a white plastic plate off the chest of the singing bear and reached inside the cavity, extending his arm all the way into the opening and pulling at whatever he could find. As he disconnected the wires inside, first the eyes stopped turning, then the eyelids stopped clapping shut, then the mouth stopped singing, and the head stopped turning. Finally, with one last jostle, the eyelids clamped shut, and the head dropped to the side lifelessly. The man stepped back, and the heavy plate of the bear's chest cavity swung shut with a clang, as the animatronic bear filled with the sounds of servos and wheels, broken and disconnected, unable to move or function. Spurts of air burst from between the seams of his body casing as the air hoses misfired. The sound came to a stop, the echoes from it lingering for a moment before dying away. The man turned his attention back to the table and lurched to it. He looked down, studying the writhing figure that lay there for a moment. The table's surface was glowing orange, and the hot metal hissed. He took a syringe from the woman's hand and thrust it into the squirming thing forcefully. He drew the plunger up, holding the needle steady as the syringe filled with molten substance, then finally pulled away with a jolt. He staggered back toward the bear.
"Now let us put you to greater purpose," he said to the glowing syringe.
The man again pried open the heavy chest plate of the standing, broken bear, then carefully inserted the syringe he held directly into the chest cavity and began to press the plunger down. The cavity snapped shut, too heavy for the frail man to hold open, and he fell backward clutching his arm. The syringe clattered to the ground, still nearly full. The woman rushed to kneel by his side, feeling his arm for breaks.
"I'm fine," he grumbled,
and glanced up at the still motionless bear.
"It needs to be heated more."
The hissing sound continued as the figure turned on the table, pushing off plumes of steam as it rolled on the hot surface.
"We can't heat it more," the woman said. "You'll destroy them."
The man looked up at her with a warm smile, then jerked his eyes back to the bear. He was now looking down at them, his eyes open wide and tracking their subtlest movements.
"Their lives will now have a greater purpose," the man said contentedly. "They will become more, just like you did."
He looked up at the woman kneeling over him, and she looked back, her glossy painted cheeks gleaming in the light. John let himself into his apartment and locked the deadbolt behind him, sliding the chain into place for the first time since he moved in. He went to the window and fiddled with the blinds, then stopped, pushing back the impulse to close them and seal himself away completely from the outside world. On the other side of the glass, the parking lot was still and silent, cast in the eerie light of a single street lamp and the blue neon sign of a nearby car dealership. There was an unfamiliar whirring sound coming from somewhere, and John watched the parking lot for a moment, not sure what he was expecting to see. The sound was gone soon after anyway, and he went into the bathroom to splash water on his face. When he came back into his bedroom, he froze. It was the sound again, this time louder. It was in the room with him. John held his breath, straining to listen. It was a quiet noise, the sound of something moving, but it was too regular, too mechanical to be a mouse. He flipped on the light. The noise continued, and he slowly turned, trying to hear where it was coming from, and found himself looking at Theodore.
"Is that you?"
he asked.
He stepped closer and picked up the disembodied rabbit's head. He held it to his ear, listening to the strange sound emanating from inside the stuffed creature. There was a sudden click, and the sound stopped. John waited, but the toy was silent. He put Theodore back down on the dresser and waited for a moment to see if the sound would begin again.
"I'm not crazy," John said to the rabbit, "and I won't let you or anyone else convince me that I am."
He went to his bed, reaching under the mattress with a suspicious glance at the toy rabbit, suddenly feeling watched. He took out the notebook he had hidden there and sat back on the bed, looking at its black and white cover. It was a plain composition notebook, the kind with a little place on the front for your name and class subject. John had left that blank, and now he traced the empty lines with his finger, not really wanting to open the book that had sat, untouched, beneath his mattress for nearly 3 months now. At last he sighed and opened to the first page.
"I'm not crazy," he spoke to the rabbit again. "I know what I saw."
"Charlie." He filled up the first page with nothing but facts and statistics, of which he knew embarrassingly few, he realized. He'd known Charlie's father, but not her mother. Her brother was still a mystery. He didn't even know if she'd been born in New Harmony, or if there was some other town before Fredbear's, the diner they had discovered that first time they all returned to Freddy's. He had painstakingly written out their shared history, childhood and hurricane, then the tragedy at Freddy's, then her father's suicide. She had moved in with her Aunt Jen after that. As he wrote that down, John realized that he had never known where Charlie and Jen lived. Close enough to Hurricane that she had driven rather than flown there for the dedication of Michael's Memorial Scholarship nearly 2 years ago, but it seemed odd that she had never even mentioned the name of the town where she now, and then, lived. He flipped through the pages. They grew less and less sparse as he had continued, the details filling in more and more as he called them over and over to mind. He had scribbled whole scenes of memory, like the time he put gum in her hair, thinking it would be funny. Charlie had stared at him with an impish look on her face as their first grade teacher cut it out of her hair with little blue-handled safety scissors. Charlie had managed to retrieve that clump of hairy gum from the trash when no one was looking and took it outside with her during recess. As soon as they were out the door, Charlie grinned at John.
"I want to give you your gum back," she said,
and the afternoon became a game of chase as they careened around the schoolyard, Charlie determined to shove the hair-encrusted piece of chewing gum back into John's mouth. She had not succeeded. They were caught and both given time out. John smiled as he read the scribbled version of the story. It had seemed important to start with their childhood, to ground himself in the Charlie that was and the John that was as well. Now he sighed and flipped ahead. In the later pages, he had tried to capture everything about her, the way she moved, the way she spoke. It was hard. The more time passed, the more the memories would be John's memory of Charlie and not Charlie. And so he had written down as much as he could, as fast as he could, starting 3 days after that night. There was the way she walked, self-assured until she realized someone was looking at her. There were the non-sequiturs she tended to toss out every time she got nervous around people, which was often. There was the way she sometimes seemed to sink into herself, as if there were another reality going on inside her head, and she had stepped momentarily outside this one and into somewhere he could never follow. He sighed. How do you check for that? He flipped the notebook over. He had started a different set of thoughts from the back. What happened to Charlie? If the woman at Carlton's party, the woman who had appeared so suddenly at the diner,
was not Charlie, then who was she? The most obvious answer, of course, would be her twin. Charlie had always referred to a boy, but Sammy could easily be short for Samantha, and the memory Charlie had confided in him of Sammy being taken from the closet was a kidnapping, not a murder. What if Charlie's twin was still alive? What if she had been not only kidnapped by Springtrap, William Afton at the time, but raised by him? What if she had been shaped and molded by a psychopath for 17 years, primed with all the knowledge Springtrap could glean from Charlie's life, and now she had been sent to take Charlie's place? But why? What would be the point of that? Afton's fixation on Charlie was disturbing, but he didn't seem capable of anything so elaborate, or of caring for a human child long enough to brainwash her. He had written out a dozen other possible theories, but when he read them over now, none really felt right. They either fell apart upon scrutiny, or, like the imagined Samantha, they made no real sense. And in all cases, he could not match them to the Charlie he had met earlier that night. Her sorrow and her bemusement had seemed so real. Picturing her face now raised a dull ache in his chest. John closed the book, trying to imagine for a moment the situation reversed. Charlie, his Charlie, turning from him, insisting that he was not himself, that he, the real John, was dead. I'd fall apart. He would feel the way Charlie had looked tonight, pleading, hugging herself as if it was all she could do to hold herself in one piece. He lay back on the bed, holding the book to his chest, where it sat, heavier than its weight. He closed his eyes, clutching the book like a child's toy, and as he drifted to sleep, he heard the sound from Theodore's head again, the whirring, and then the click. The next day, John woke up late and filled with a rootless dread. He glanced at the clock, realized in a panic that he was late for work, and almost simultaneously recalled that there was no more work, a reality that would have consequences soon enough, but not today. All he had to do today was meet Charlie. The dread swelled again at the thought of it, and he sighed. Late that afternoon, as he dug through his dresser for a presentable shirt, someone knocked at the door. John glanced at Theodore. "Who?" John whispered. The rabbit didn't answer. John went to the door. Through the front window, he saw Clay Burke standing outside staring at the door, apparently politely ignoring the fact that he could see right into John's apartment if he wanted to. John sighed and slid the chain off the latch, then opened the door wide. "Clay, hey, come in." Clay hesitated on the threshold, glancing at the interior that was too sparse to be a mess. John shrugged. "Before you judge, remember that I've seen your place look worse than this," he said, and Clay smiled. "Yes, you have," he said at last, and came inside. The noise from Theodore's head started again, but John chose to ignore it. "What is that?" Clay asked after a few seconds. John waited to answer, knowing the sound would stop soon, and after a moment it did, with the same click as before. "It's the rabbit head," John smiled. "Right, of course." Clay looked toward the dresser, then back at John as though nothing was out of the ordinary. Considering what they'd been through in the past, it really wasn't. "So, what can I do for you?" John asked before something stranger could happen. Clay rocked on his heels momentarily. "I wanted to see how you were doing," he said lightly. "Really? Didn't we have that talk yesterday?" John said dryly. He stood again and grabbed a clean shirt from his dresser and went into the bathroom to change.
Yeah, well, you know, you can never be too sure, Clay said, raising his voice to be heard. John turned on the faucet.
John, what do you know about Charlie's Aunt Jen?
John turned the faucet off abruptly, jarred out of his petulant mood.
Clay, what did you say?
I said, what do you know about Charlie's aunt? John changed his shirt quickly and came back out into the bedroom.
Aunt Jen? I never met her.
Clay gave him a sharp look.
You never saw her?
I didn't say that, John said.
Why are you asking me this now?
Clay hesitated.
Charlie became very eager to see you again when I mentioned that you had seen Jen that night, he said,
seeming to choose his words with care.
Why would Charlie care if I saw Jen or not? For that matter, why do you?
John reached past Clay to grab a belt hanging off the foot of the bed and began to slip it through the loops of his jeans.
It just made me realize that there is a lot we don't know about that night, Clay said. I think your conversation with Charlie tonight can help fill in those gaps, if you ask the right questions. You want me to interrogate her?
John laughed without humor. Clay sighed, frustration leaking through his habitual calm.
That's not what I'm asking, John. All I'm saying is, if Charlie's aunt was there that night, then I'd like to ask her a question or two.
John stared at Clay, who just looked back at him placidly, waiting. John grabbed a pair of socks and sat down on the bed.
Why are you suddenly coming to me anyway? He asked. No one's believed anything I've said so far. It's what we found at the compound,
Clay answered, more easily than John had expected. He straightened.
The compound? You mean Charlie's dad's house?
Clay gave him a level look.
I think we both know it was more than just a house, he said.
John shrugged and said nothing, waiting for him to go on.
Some of the things we found in the wreckage were... They didn't mean much to anyone else, but what I saw... Some of the things I saw down there were pretty scary, even though most of it was buried under concrete and metal.
Scary? Was that the conclusion of your entire team, or just you? John said, not bothering to keep the sarcasm out of his voice. Clay didn't seem to hear him, his eyes fixed on a point between them.
Clay? John said, alarmed. What did you find? What do you mean, scary?
Clay blinked.
I wouldn't be sure how else to describe it, he said.
John shook his head.
I will say this, Clay said harshly. I'm not ready to close the book on the Dave/William Afton/whatever else he was calling himself. Springtrap, John said quietly. I'm not ready to close the book on that case.
Clay finished.
What does that mean? You think he's still alive? I just think we can't make any assumptions, Clay said.
John shrugged again. He was out of patience. Out of interest, almost. He was sick of intrigue. Clay withholding information, trying to protect them, as if keeping secrets had kept any of them safe, ever.
What do you want me to ask her? John said plainly. Just get her to talk to you. It's been wonderful having her here again, don't misunderstand. But it seems like she's holding something back. It's like she's...
Not herself, John said with an edge of mocking.
That's not what I was going to say, but I think she might know something she hasn't told us yet. Maybe something that she hasn't felt comfortable sharing.
And she might feel comfortable sharing it with me?
Maybe.
That feels morally ambiguous, John said wearily. From the dresser, The whirring noise started again.
See? Theodore agrees with me, he said, gesturing toward the rabbit. Does it always do that?
Clay reached for the rabbit's head, but before he could touch it, Theodore's jaw snapped open and the head jerked in place. John startled, and Clay took a quick step back. They both watched, transfixed, as the sound went on, though the head did not move again. The sound it was making became a distorted murmur, louder and softer, at times almost mimicking words, though John could not even begin to make them out. After a few minutes, the head fell silent again.
I've never seen it do that before, John said.
Clay was bent over the dresser, his nose almost touching Theodore's, as if he could see inside.
I need to go soon, John said shortly. I don't want to be late, right? For this new open and honest relationship that I'm starting with her.
He made brief, accusing eye contact with Clay, and went briskly to the door.
Don't you need to lock it?
Clay asked as John brushed past him.
It doesn't matter.
It was still light out when John got to St. George, and when he looked at the dashboard clock, John saw that he was over an hour early. He parked in the restaurant lot anyway and got out, glad for the opportunity to walk around and burn some nervous energy. He had avoided St. George, the town where Charlie and Jessica had been in college. Jessica probably still is in college, he thought with a pang of guilt. I should know basic stuff like this. He walked past a few storefronts, heading semi-consciously for the movie theater he had been to with Charlie the last time he was here. Maybe we can go see a movie. After the dinner and interrogation. John stopped short on the sidewalk. The theater was gone. Instead, two gigantic clown faces grinned at him from the windows of a gleaming new restaurant. The faces were almost as large as the wide front door, painted on either side, and above them was a sign in red and yellow neon letters, Circus Baby's Pizza. The neon lights were on, glowing uselessly in the daylight. John stood motionless, feeling like his sneakers had fused to the parking lot. A group of kids rushed past him on their way in, and a teenager bumped into John, breaking him out of his daze.
Just keep walking, John,
he muttered to himself, turning to move away, but he stopped again after only a few steps.
Just keep walking,
he repeated in a sterner tone, and turned to face the restaurant defiantly. He approached the front door and pushed it. It opened into an empty vestibule, a waiting area, where smaller versions of the clowns out front smiled crazily from the walls, and a second door read, Welcome, in painted cursive letters. There was a familiar smell in the air, some particular combination of rubber, sweat, and cooking pizza. John opened the second door, and noise exploded. He blinked in the fluorescent lights, bewildered. Children were everywhere, screaming and laughing and running across the floor, and the jingles and blips of arcade games sounded discordantly from around the room. There were play structures, something like a jungle gym to his left and a large ball pit to his right, where two small girls were throwing brightly colored balls at a third girl, who was shouting something he could not make out. There were tables set up in the center of the room, where he noticed five or six adults talking to one another. Occasionally, they'd look over their shoulders at the chaos surrounding them, at the stage in back of the room, its red curtain closed. A chill went down his spine, and he looked around again with a terrible déjà vu at the playing children and complacent parents. He started toward the stage, twice stopping just in time to avoid tripping over a game of tag. The curtains were brand new, the red velvet plush and gleaming in the light,
and trimmed with golden ropes and tassels. John slowed his pace as he got closer, the pit of his stomach tensing with an old, familiar dread. The stage floor was about level with his waist, and he stopped beside it and glanced around, then carefully grasped the thick curtain and began to pull it back.
"Excuse me, sir." A man's voice came from behind him, and John straightened like he'd touched a hot stove.
"Sorry," he said, turning to see a man wearing a yellow polo shirt and a tense expression.
"Are you here with your children, sir?"
he asked, raising his eyebrows. The shirt read, "Circus Baby's Pizza," and he was wearing a name tag that read, "Steve."
"No, I..." John paused. "Yes, several children. Birthday party, you know. Cousins, so many cousins. What can you do?"
Steve was still looking at him with raised eyebrows.
"I have to go meet someone. Somewhere else," John said.
Steve gestured to the door. Chapter 4.
"No!"
Jessica cried in dismay as she wrangled her keys from the pocket of her fashionably too tight jeans. An apple tumbled out of the paper grocery bag she was struggling to balance on her hip and rolled away down the hallway. It came to rest on the welcome mat of her worst neighbor, a middle-aged man who seemed capable of detecting the tiniest noise, then promptly complaining about it. In fact, since she moved into the apartment 6 months ago, leaving behind the dorm room she and Charlie had shared, he had come to her door 3 times to complain about her radio. Twice, it had not even been on. Mostly, he just glared at her whenever they passed in the hall. Jessica didn't really mind the hostility. It was a little like being back home in New York. She left the apple where it was. Having managed to get the door open, Jessica dropped the bags on the kitchen counter and looked around the room with a quiet satisfaction. The apartment wasn't very fancy, but it was hers. When she first moved in, she had gone on a cleaning rampage, scouring out the baked-in dirt that must have been lining the baseboards since the building went up some 50 years ago. It had taken almost 2 weeks of nothing but scrubbing between classes and homework, and she went to bed every night with sore arms, as though she'd done nothing but weight training. But now the apartment was clean enough for Jessica, albeit just barely, which was no small bar to clear. She began taking things out of the grocery bags, lining everything up on the counter before putting each item away. "Peanut butter, bread, milk, bananas," she muttered to herself, then fell silent. Something is wrong. She looked around the room carefully, but there was no one there, and everything seemed to be where she'd last left it. She returned to the grocery bags. As she closed the refrigerator door, the hair at the back of her neck prickled. Jessica whirled around as though expecting to catch a burglar in the act, her heart jolting with adrenaline, but the room was still. Just to be sure, she went to check the door. It was locked, as expected. She stood in silence for a moment, listening to the distant sounds of her apartment complex. The hum of an air conditioning unit outside, a leaf blower across the street. But nothing seemed out of the ordinary. She stepped carefully back to the counter and finished putting away the groceries, then headed to her bedroom. She turned the corner to the hallway and screamed. A figure stood in the dark, blocking the way. "Jessica?" said a familiar voice, and Jessica reached hastily for the light switch, tensed to run. The light flickered on slowly. It was Charlie.
"Did I scare you?" Charlie said uncertainly.
"Sorry, the door was unlocked. I should have waited outside," she added, looking down at her shoes. "I just figured since we used to be roomies anyway."
"Charlie, you scared me to death,"
Jessica said in a mock scolding tone.
What are you doing here?
I told you I'm having dinner with John, Charlie said, and Jessica nodded.
Could I borrow something to wear? Maybe you could help me pick something out?
Charlie looked hesitant, like she was asking an immense favor, and Jessica gave her a puzzled frown.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Jessica tried to calm herself.
But Charlie, it's not like you need my help choosing an outfit these days.
Jessica gestured at Charlie's clothing. She was wearing her habitual combat boots, or a more elegant version of them, but she had paired them with a medium-length black skirt and a dark red, scoop-necked blouse. Charlie shrugged and shifted her feet.
I just think he might like me better if you help me pick an outfit, instead of me dressing myself, you know? John doesn't seem to like my new look.
Well, Charlie... Jessica stopped, choosing her words carefully.
It won't do either of you any good to pretend nothing has changed, she said firmly. Wear what you have on. You look great.
You think so? Charlie said, looking doubtful.
Yeah,
Jessica said. She brushed past Charlie to go into her room, stepping cautiously past her, and Charlie followed, pausing in the doorway like a vampire waiting for an invitation. Jessica looked at Charlie and was suddenly set at ease, as if their friendship had never been interrupted. Jessica grinned.
So, I mean, are you nervous? She asked, going to her dresser for her hairbrush, and Charlie came in and sat down on the bed. I feel like I have to prove something to him, but I'm not sure what, she said, tracing the flower design on Jessica's bedspread.
You were right, by the way.
Jessica turned around, brushing her hair absently.
He wants to see you tonight. I think that's a great start, she offered.
Just let him spend some time with you. He's been through a lot. Remember, from his perspective, he saw you die, right in front of his eyes.
Charlie laughed, a soft, forced sound, then was silent.
I'm just worried about him, and I can't even help him because...
She broke off.
Jessica, do you remember him telling me something important that night?
Something in her tone changed. It was subtle, just a hint of strain. Jessica kept her expression neutral, pretending not to notice.
Something important? Jessica asked.
Something that I would remember, should remember. She kept her eyes on the bedspread, still tracing the pattern like she was trying to memorize it. Jessica hesitated. She could still see it all, as vivid as the present, though it gave her a sick feeling in the pit of her stomach. Charlie was trapped in the twisted, broken Freddy suit, with just her arm free. John was holding her hand. Jessica shuddered, that terrible, singular crunching sound echoing in her head.
Jessica? Charlie asked, and Jessica nodded briskly.
Sorry.
She cleared her throat.
I don't know. You and John were alone together for a few minutes. I'm not sure what he said.
Why?
I think it's important to him that I remember, Charlie said, back to tracing the bedspread. Jessica watched her for a moment, suddenly ill at ease in her own bedroom. As if sensing it, Charlie stood and met her eyes.
Thanks, Jessica, she said. Sorry again for breaking in. I mean, I didn't break in. The door was unlocked. But you know what I mean.
No problem. Just announce yourself sooner next time.
Jessica smiled, feeling a rush of warmth for her friend. She hugged Charlie goodbye at the door. Charlie walked a few steps and picked the apple up off the ground, then handed it back to Jessica.
I think this belongs to you.
Charlie smiled, then turned to walk away. When she had closed the door, Jessica sighed. The anxiety that had risen while Charlie was in her room had not abated. She leaned back against the door, replaying what had just happened. Why would John want Charlie to remember the last thing he said to her? She tossed the apple a few inches into the air, then let it fall back into her hand. "He's testing her," Jessica said to the empty apartment. Outside Jessica's building, Charlie stopped in the parking lot, frustrated. What did he say that was so important? She walked across the baked pavement to her car. Charlie climbed into her car, slamming the door shut with more force than she needed to. She stared petulantly at the steering wheel. "They're lying to me," she thought. "I feel like a little kid, with all the grown-ups keeping secrets from me, deciding for me what I should and shouldn't know." She glanced at her watch. The clock in the car was either an hour ahead or an hour behind, and she could never remember which. She had about 20 minutes before she had to meet John. "I can't show up early," she said plainly. "Then he really won't believe it's me." Trying to shrug off her bad mood, Charlie put the car in gear and pulled out of the lot. When she got to the restaurant, she could see John through the window, seated at the same table they had sat at last time, all the way in the back. He was staring into space, as if he were deep in thought, or completely zoned out. She followed the hostess to his table, and it was only when she was standing right beside him that he seemed to realize she was there. When he did, he stood hastily. Charlie started to move toward him, but he sat back down, and she quickly sidestepped and did the same. "Hi," she said with an awkward smile. "Hi, Charlie," he said quietly, then grinned suddenly. "You're dressed a lot nicer than last time we were here."
"It probably just seems that way because I'm not covered in dirt and blood this time," Charlie said lightly.
"Right."
He laughed, but there was a quick instant of appraisal in his eyes. That was a test. The thought sent something cold through the pit of her stomach. She had known it would happen, but knowing did not make it easier to have his eyes, usually so warm, look at her with calculation.
"What was that movie we saw?" John asked, seeming to fumble at an answer. "Last time I visited, we went to that theater down the street, didn't we? It's on the tip of my tongue."
"Zombies versus Zombies," Charlie said.
"Right, I knew it was about zombies," John said thoughtfully.
"So, what have you been doing since then?" Charlie asked, attempting to shift the topic. "Are you still doing construction work?"
"Yeah," John said, then cast his eyes down at the table. "Actually, maybe not. I just got fired."
"Oh," Charlie said. "I'm sorry."
He nodded.
"Yeah, I mean, it was my fault. I showed up late, and there was some other stuff. But I really liked that job. Well, it was a job at least."
"There have to be other building sites," Charlie said.
"Yeah, I guess."
He looked at her searchingly, and she looked back, trying not to shrink under scrutiny.
"Believe me," she pleaded silently. "What will it take for you to believe me?" "I've missed this," she said instead.
He nodded, his eyes softening for a moment.
"Me too,"
he said quietly, though she knew it was only half true.
"You know, I didn't leave because of... it wasn't because of you," Charlie said. "I'm sorry if it seemed like it was. I just had to get away from everything and everyone. I..."
"Are you folks ready to order?"
the waitress asked brightly. John straightened his posture and cleared his throat. Charlie looked down at the menu, glad of the interruption, but the pictures of food looked strange, as if she had heard food described, but never seen any. Miss? The waitress was looking at her expectantly.
I'll have the same, Charlie said quickly and shut the menu. The young woman frowned confusedly.
Oh, okay. I guess I should order then.
John laughed.
Anything will be fine.
Charlie sat patiently.
I'm sorry, I'll be right back.
She got up from the table hastily and headed for the bathroom, leaving John to take care of things. Walking into the bathroom, she was struck with a jarring sense of déjà vu. I've been here before. Trapped in a box. I was trapped in a box. Charlie slammed the door shut and locked it. I'm not trapped. She ran her fingers through her hair, though it didn't really need adjusting, and washed her hands. She was just killing time, stealing a moment away from John's scrutiny. Every time he gave her that level, untrusting look, she felt exposed.
I am Charlie, she said to her reflection, smoothing down her hair again nervously. I don't have to convince John that I'm me.
The words sounded thin in the small room.
Who else would I be?
Charlie washed her hands again, straightened her shoulders, and went back out into the dining room. She sat down and put her paper napkin in her lap, then looked John squarely in the eye.
I still don't remember, she said abruptly, seized by an obstinate recklessness.
John raised his eyebrows.
What?
I don't remember what you said to me that night. I know it's important to you. I know maybe it's why you think what you think about me, but I just don't remember. I can't change that.
Okay.
He slid his hands off the edge of the table and let them rest in his lap.
I know that. A lot happened that night. I know.
He sighed for a moment, but then smiled almost reassuringly. Charlie bit her lip.
If it's that important, why can't you just tell me?
She asked gently. Instantly, she could see that it was the wrong thing to say. John's features hardened. He drew back from the table slightly. She looked down at the napkin in her lap. She had been shredding the corner of it without noticing.
Never mind, she said, her voice barely above a whisper, letting several long minutes pass. Forget I said anything.
She looked up, but John didn't respond.
Excuse me for just a minute. I'll be right back.
He got up and left the table. She stared at his empty chair. The waitress approached and cleared her throat. Charlie heard her, but did not move. She wasn't sure she could move.
This is going horribly. Maybe I'll just sit here forever. I'll be a statue of myself, a monument to Charlie that was, Charlie that will never be again.
Miss? The waitress sounded concerned, and it was enough for Charlie to, with Herculean effort, turn her head.
Is everything all right, miss?
The waitress asked, and it took Charlie another long moment to comprehend the question.
Yes, she said at last. Could I have another napkin?
She held up the first, half-shredded, as evidence of her need, and the waitress went away. Charlie turned back to John's empty chair. John slid back into view and sat down, breaking the line of her vacant stare.
Everything okay? He asked.
She nodded.
The waitress is getting me another napkin.
Charlie gestured vaguely in the direction the waitress had gone.
Right.
He opened his mouth to go on, but before he could speak, the waitress returned, carrying Charlie's napkin along with their food. They were both silent as she placed it in front of them, and John smiled at her.
Thanks, he said.
Charlie stared at her plate. It was some kind of pasta. She took her fork carefully but didn't start to eat.
Can I ask you something?
John finally said, and she nodded eagerly,
setting the fork back down. He took a deep breath. That night, how did you survive? There was so much blood. He stopped, at a loss for words. Charlie looked at him, at the familiar face that had somehow turned against her. She had been trying to piece together a story for him, but now she just spoke. I don't know, she said. There's time missing. When I try to think about it, my mind flinches away, like it's hit something sharp. The distance in John's eyes faded a little as she spoke. I'd been in a suit before, she went on. I think I must have figured out how to get away somehow, or at least how to position myself. She looked anxiously at him, and his gaze sharpened. I still don't understand. How did you manage to get away undamaged? He looked her up and down again, seeming to examine her. Charlie's breath caught in her throat, and she turned away from him, staring fixedly out the window at the parking lot. I didn't, she said tightly. John didn't answer, searching Charlie's half-turned face for a spark of something he could recognize, or not recognize. She was saying all the right things, in all the right ways, and her hints, more than hints, at the unshakable trauma she had gone through that night made his stomach clench. As she gazed off into the middle distance, her jaw was clenched. She looked like she was fighting something off, and John was seized with a sudden urge to go to her, to hold out his hand and offer his help. Instead, he picked up his fork and began to eat, looking down at his plate instead of at her. She knows what I'm doing, he thought, chewing grimly. She's giving me the right answers. Some detective I've turned out to be. John took another bite and stole a glance at her. She was still looking off at the parking lot. He swallowed and cleared his throat. Before he could speak, Charlie turned back to him. After that night, I had to get away, she said. Her voice was hoarse, and her face was strained, her features seeming harsher than before. I had to leave everything behind, John. Everything. My whole life has been haunted by what happened here, and the last couple of years, even before that, too. It's just been my whole life. She met his eyes briefly, then looked away, blinking rapidly like she was holding back tears. I wanted to be somebody different. I had to, or I'd go insane. I know it's a cliche to think you can change your life if you change your hair and your clothes. She gave an ironic half-smile and flipped her long hair over her shoulder. But I couldn't be your Charlie forever, that naive little girl, scared of her own shadow, living in a shadow. Honestly, I don't even know what you saw in that girl. Selfish, scatterbrained, pathetic. She said the last word so caustically that she almost shook with it, a sour look coming over her face, as if loathing for her past self had overwhelmed her. I never thought you were any of those things, John said quietly and looked down. He ran his fork along the rim of his plate, not knowing what to say. He made himself look up. Charlie's face had softened, and now she seemed anxious. But it's still me. She shrugged, her voice breaking. He couldn't answer. He didn't know where to start. Charlie bit her lip. You still think it, don't you? She said after a moment. John shifted uncomfortably in his seat, ashamed, but Charlie pressed on. John, please, I don't understand. If you think I'm not me, then what do you think? Who can you possibly think I am? She looked utterly bewildered, and again John felt himself wavering. I think, He gestured graspingly at the air, catching nothing.
Charlie, what I saw, he exclaimed, then stopped short, remembering they were in public.
He glanced around, but no one was looking at them. The restaurant was not busy, but everyone there was occupied, the guests talking to the people they came with, the staff talking among themselves.
I saw you die, he said, lowering his voice. When you walked into that diner the next day, Charlie, I wanted to believe it was true. I still want to believe it. But I saw you die, he finished helplessly.
Charlie shook her head slowly.
I'm telling you that I'm alive. How can that not be enough? If you want to believe me, why don't you?
The pain in her voice sent a pang of guilt through him, but he met her eyes calmly.
Because I'd rather know the truth than believe something just because it would make me happy.
Charlie looked at him searchingly.
So, what do you think is the truth? Who do you...
She swallowed and started again.
Who do you think I am, if I'm not me?
John sighed.
I've thought about it a lot, he said at last. Almost constantly, actually.
Charlie nodded slightly, barely moving her head, like she was afraid she would spook him.
I thought about a lot of things, I guess. Theories,
Like what?
Charlie asked gently.
Well, John's face was getting hot. I should never have agreed to see her.
John?
I guess maybe I thought you might be Sammy, he mumbled.
She looked puzzled for a moment, like she had not quite heard him. Then her eyes widened.
Sammy's dead, she said tightly.
John looked up at the ceiling and put his hands to his temples.
I know, he said, and met her eyes again. But, Charlie, look, I don't know that. Neither do you. The last thing you remember of Sammy, what was it?
You know the answer to that, she said in a low, level voice.
You saw him being taken, John said after a moment.
She made no response, and he took it as license to continue.
You saw him being kidnapped, not killed, by Dave or Afton, Springtrap. So what if he wasn't killed? What if Sammy was raised by William Afton, twisted, and brought up by a murderous madman to replace you, to replace Charlie after her death? Also, Sammy could be short for Samantha. I forgot that part. Sammy could have been a girl all along.
Charlie was motionless across the table. She scarcely looked like she was breathing.
I know how it sounds when I say it out loud, John added in a rush. That's why I mostly don't.
Charlie had covered her face with her hand, and her shoulders were shaking. He broke off as she looked up. This time she was laughing. There was a manic edge to it, like it might turn back into crying at any moment, but John tentatively tried to smile.
Oh, John, she said at last. I don't even... You know that's crazy, right?
Is it crazier than anything else we've seen?
He argued without much conviction.
John... You took me to see the grave yourself, remember?
John paused and looked confused for a moment, trying to reconcile what he'd just heard.
You took me yourself to Sammy's grave.
I took you to the cemetery, but I never saw Sammy's grave, or your father's, John corrected.
Then go look sometime.
Charlie's voice was patient. John felt immediately foolish.
Aunt Jen warned me not to come back to Hurricane.
Charlie looked down at the table.
She's 3 for 3 at this point. Have you heard from her, by the way?
From your aunt?
John asked, disconcerted by the sudden change of subject. I figured you were living with her after you moved out of Jessica's place.
Yeah,